We will have June again. So let me welcome June back.
Good morning. My name is June again. I'm an alcoholic. Juan, thank you so much. That'll be one of my special memories about Thailand. Thank you. Oh, I'm a person who I really believe that the speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous that I heard in my early months and years were the ones that gave me the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and their stories. And I carry a lot of their stories with me, and I brought a couple of stories with me this morning that I want to share with you guys. You know, I'm the kind of a person, I'm very bad oftentimes at remembering people's names, but I'll remember the guy who's dog drank vodka, you know. That's just kind of the way I work. And, you know, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, as I mentioned last night, hating myself and pretty much hating everybody else, I think that's why the speakers were so important, is because I wasn't a person who could accept a lot of hugs or any kind of, you know, physical affection. But I believe that the speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous are what, for me, was the language of the heart, because they touched me with the things that they shared. And I had planned this morning, and I'm going to talk to you guys about a woman named Sybil, because I was thinking about how Thailand AA is going to be growing. And what an amazing adventure all of you have ahead of you. This woman named Sybil was the first woman to get sober in the Western United States. I'm pretty sure Sybil was the second woman to ever get sober in Los Angeles, in the world, in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm not 100% sure she was second, but I'm pretty sure. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about Sybil's story. When Sybil was a mom, and she kept drinking, even though she didn't want to, because of course that's part of what happens with alcoholism, and she would end up in different cities sometimes, not knowing where her daughter was. And she was really horrified at her alcoholism. And she heard about a little article that talked about Alcoholics Anonymous, this new organization that was helping drunks in 1940, and it was in New York. And she wrote a letter to New York asking if she could come to their AA hospital to get help. And New York wrote back and said, "We don't have an AA hospital, but there actually is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous once a week in Los Angeles, and you should go to that meeting." So Sybil was very scared. So she got her husband, who wanted her to get help with her drinking, to take her to the meeting. They got to the meeting that night, and it was in a big hall. She was the only woman. There were other women and men, and they were sort of standing in the hall, and they were all chatting and talking. And then one of the people said, "Okay, it's time for the meeting to start. All the women have to leave." So all the women left, and all the men went into the meeting. And that meant that Sybil was thrown out, and Sybil's husband was taken into the meeting. Now, back then in Los Angeles, because there was one meeting a week, the people there had driven sometimes 2, 3, 4, even 5 hours to get to that meeting. There was only one. So they didn't really have a time frame. You know, the meeting didn't have to end, you know, in an hour. They took as long as they needed to. And with Sybil's husband being there, he explained to them that he wasn't an alcoholic, but they'd heard that before. So They spent, you know, 3 or 4 hours trying to help him see his problem. And he finally got out of there. And Sybil was outside waiting for him, and they left. And he was very upset. And Sybil just went, dropped him off at home, and went straight to a bar and got really drunk. And at the late in the night, after she was really drunk, she remembered that in the letter from New York, they had sent her a phone number of a guy named Cliff in Los Angeles. And so it's about 2 or 3 in the morning, and that's when the bars close in Los Angeles, and that's the best time to make phone calls after you've been drunk. So she called that guy, Cliff, who she hadn't met, and she said, "I just wanted to let you know, buddy, that I'm reporting you to New York for throwing me out of the meeting, and I'll have your job. That's it." And he said, "You know, Sybil, we've never had a woman come. I was working tonight. I wasn't there. Please come back next week. Please come back to our meeting next Sunday night." Well, believe it or not, Sybil's husband was not going back to that meeting. And she didn't want to go alone. So Sybil was very close. One of her great drinking buddies was her brother, a guy named Tex. But most of the time, Tex wouldn't drink with Sybil because she always got him into a lot of trouble and a lot more fighting than even he wanted to get into. So he was very happy that Sybil was going to get some help and stop drinking. And she said, "Tex, you know, I'm going to this AA thing. Please come with me." And he said, "You know, this sounds kind of interesting." Tex ran a farm. And he said, "I have a lot of these guys working for me, and they drink too much. So I'm going to tell them they all have to go to the meeting or they're fired." And Tex had a truck. And so that Sunday, I think it was a Sunday night, Tex and Sybil sat in the front, and the 8 guys that Tex had working for him were in the back of the truck, and they all went to the meeting. And they walked in, about 10 of them, which was more people than were actually members of Alcoholics Anonymous at that time in the meeting. And they sat, and the meeting began. And after about an hour, the meeting ended. And at the end of the meeting, the guy named Cliff, who was to become Sybil's sponsor, they started going. They said, "Everybody, we need you to wait right here." And they started going out to a car, and they came back in carrying like pillowcases and bags of letters, because the Jack Alexander article about Alcoholics Anonymous in 1941 had just come out. And so what they did with those bags was they had divided these bags into the areas where the members came from, who had driven 2, 3, 4, 5 hours. And I don't know your cities well enough here to explain it. But you know, someone might be, you know, from Bangkok, and someone else might be from Pattaya, and someone else might be from Chiang Mai, you know, maybe not that far, because that's probably pretty far to drive. But they called those people up from whatever area, and they gave them a pillowcase filled with the mail of the 12-step calls of people who had written to New York asking for help. And at the very end, they had one bag left. And they said, "Now this bag is all the women who have written to Alcoholics Anonymous that need help. And so, Sybil, we're going to give you this bag, and we're going to put you in charge of all the women. You need to contact all these women and 12-step them." And she said, "Oh, no, that won't work. I can't do that." And they said, "Why not?" She said, "I won't be sober in a week. I've never been sober a week." You know, and they said, "Well, we want you to go ahead and take this bag." And she said, "What would I tell these people? I don't know anything about what this is. I don't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been to one meeting." They said, "What you're going to do, Sybil, is you're going to knock on the door. And you're going to say, 'I have a problem with drinking. I've been to one meeting. I don't know very much. But if you come with me, maybe we can find out together and learn about staying sober.'" And Sybil never drank again. She died sober. I don't want to exaggerate, but I'm pretty sure she had at least 58 years of sobriety. I might even be off a little, you know, not giving her full credit for all of her time. But she never drank again. She stayed active, you know, in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's one of the things that, you know, I remember, because sometimes back home, certain groups or committees, we can get a little bit rule-bound about how long someone needs to have sober before they're allowed to go help someone else. And so I always like to remember that this is someone who'd gone to one meeting and was able to, you know, carry what she knew of the message of Alcoholics Anonymous right then. I am a person, you know, as I mentioned last night, who believes that I was born an alcoholic. And I believe in my case that there was a genetic, there's a high likelihood that there's a genetic component in that. And I feel so fortunate to have been born in a time when Alcoholics Anonymous existed. When my parents were born, Alcoholics Anonymous did not exist. When my grandfather drove drunk in a car, killing himself and all the people in his car and the people in the other car, dying at 46 years old, Alcoholics Anonymous did not even exist yet. My father was to drink himself to death alone in a hotel room. And my mother, as I mentioned to you last night, was to be in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for almost 40 years before she was able to get and stay sober. So alcoholism has really touched a lot of generations in my family. And you know, I think about, I love the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love learning about it. I love learning about the traditions, and I'm very fortunate that I was involved in a group that has taught me about that, and I continue to try and learn those things and the little trivia things about Alcoholics Anonymous, because I think they're really important. I mean, like, I love the fact that when the founder, one of the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill W., after he had 12-stepped Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob and him were sober, and we officially, you know, feel that Alcoholics Anonymous had begun. Bill at that time had 6 months sober, and then they began to work with other people, and so AA number 3 and the other AAs began to join. But Bill had 6 months. No meetings had been formed at this point yet. No book, no steps, you know, just two people, one drunk talking to another, and one of them had 6 months. Now, as the members joined, they were pretty fascinated by a guy having 6 months. And they weren't quite sure what it was that Bill was doing that was right. They just didn't know. And at that time, Bill had a stomach ailment that he'd had always with ulcers and things like that. So Bill used to drink milk and sauerkraut to help his stomach. And they didn't know if maybe that was helping Bill stay sober. So the new people in those early months were given milk and sauerkraut juice. So think how lucky you guys are, you know. We'd evolve beyond that. Let me see, what else do I want to... I want to tell you this other story. I'm going to jump all around, but that's the way I figured I'd do it. I want to tell you this other story of one of my favorite stories in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can't even tell you exactly why this means so much to me, but because it does, I'm going to pass it on to you, and maybe it'll mean something to you guys or not. I had the privilege of getting to know a guy named John Vicar, and when I knew him, he was living in the Massachusetts area, and he was a Mi'kmaq Indian, and I met him in the early 1980s. And John had grown up as a child on a reservation, and he was one of, I think, either 13 or 16 children on the reservation. And all of his family, except himself and one sister, died one season of tuberculosis. And he was a young boy, 13 or 14 at that time. And because at that time they didn't understand how tuberculosis was transmitted or what was going on, both he and his sister were forced to leave the reservation. And he did. He never learned to read or write. He had no education, no job skills. And he was living in Canada at that time, and he went and joined a lumberjack camp where he became a dishwasher. And he learned how to drink. And eventually he joined the Canadian Army, and he learned how to drink more. And when he got out of the Army, he went straight to Skid Row. And that's where he did all of his drinking and fighting and just the life of alcoholics that some of us have. And periodically, he would go stay in missions just to get off the street, you know, for a few days. And many of the missions had, you know, like they wanted the people to go to church or to join things, you know, something like that. And John was pretty against anything like that. And one time he was at the mission, and this guy said, hey, why don't you come to the AA meeting? And he was kind of like, I don't go to stuff, you know. And they said, they have donuts. He said, okay, I'll go. So he went to his first meeting because they had donuts. And he ended up seeing a guy at the meeting that he used to drink with, you know, on Skid Row, that was sober a while, maybe a year, I'm not really sure how long it was, but it was a long time to John, and the guy looked really good, and he hadn't seen him in the bars, and they hadn't been fighting in a long time. He was really amazed, and they started to talk, and this guy was to become John's sponsor, and to begin taking John to meetings every night, pick him up at the mission and take him to meetings. And the guy would pick him up to go to the meetings, and he'd say, John, I need a favor. He said, my wife made me a sandwich tonight. And he said, and I can only eat half of it. And if I go home and I didn't eat it all, it hurts her feeling and it makes her sad. So if you don't mind, could you please eat half of the sandwich and help me out? And so John was willing to help him out and eat the half a sandwich. And he said he didn't realize until years later that this guy ate dinner with his family at the table every night before he left to come pick him up. But the guy knew that if he offered John a whole sandwich, John would not have been able to accept that. But the way that he put it, you know, John was able to accept the help. And I don't know, it just, that means a lot to me, because I think sometimes I've been tricked into doing things. Maybe, as you said, when they told you you'd have to go back to step one, if you didn't move forward, you thought, oh, all right, fine, you know. But let's see, what else did... So I wanted to tell you another little story. When, after, and I'm not sure of the date, but after a while, after Alcoholics Anonymous had really become, it was an ongoing thing and it was doing well, Bill Wilson wanted to, and did, write a letter to Dr. Young to thank him for his contribution to Alcoholics Anonymous. And just in case some of you don't really know much about that, I'm going to tell you a little bit about that background part. Before Alcoholics Anonymous was ever formed, there was a guy who was a really bad drunk named Roland. And Roland was from a very wealthy family in Rhode Island. And his family sent him to the greatest psychiatrist or human psychologist in the world at the time, Dr. Young. And Roland went over and he did a year of treatment with the best in the world so that he could get over this drinking problem. And everything was pretty good. Things were working out. And Roland left, and on the plane, the first plane, he got drunk. And he couldn't believe it. He turned around and he flew back. And he said, how can this be? I didn't even want to drink. I wanted to stay sober. We worked through all my issues, you know, and I still drank again. And Dr. Young said to Roland, he said, you know, my experience actually with people who drink like you is pretty much that they're doomed. There is nothing I know anyone has ever found that can help chronic alcoholics of your type. With one exception, I've sometimes seen individuals experience some type of a spiritual experience or a psychic change that has allowed them to stay sober. But we don't know how to make it happen. We don't have any, you know, we tried. He said, that's what I've been trying to do with you for the past year. It didn't work. So sorry, buddy. You know, there's nothing I can do. And Roland went on, and I'm not going to give you the whole AA history thing. If you want to hear about it, you can read AA Comes of Age, or you can read some of the chapters, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous in the big book, and you'll find out a little bit more about Roland. But anyway, eventually that information was transmitted to Bill Wilson, and it was an important part of the steps, and important in the spiritual experience that's written about in the appendix to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So years later, Bill Wilson, it occurs to him, you know, I should thank that guy. And he writes to Dr. Young and he says, I want to let you know that you made a very important contribution to Alcoholics Anonymous by telling Roland that, and it's helped a lot of us, and there are lots of us sober today, and it really made a difference, so thank you. And Dr. Young wrote back, and I'm paraphrasing, that's all I do really. And Dr. Young wrote back and he said, you know, thank you for your letter. I'm thrilled believe me, I'm sure he didn't say I'm thrilled. You know, I mean, it's Dr. Young after all, but hey, I'm from California. So anyway, I said, I'm very happy to know that I made a difference and that I could have helped anybody. That's great. He said, but I want to mention something. He said, it's been my experience that just having a psychic change doesn't seem to be enough. And I want to mention this to you. He said, my experience has been that after the psychic change, the individual needs to keep in close contact with some kind of a community that can give them support, or it doesn't last. And I believe that that is where the importance of the fellowship and the meetings and conventions like this and the committees that you get a chance to be on, I think it's really important. You know, I'm sure that there is someone or more than one person in every row in this room today who has some type of a difficult problem going on in their life. And I've had my share, or I've had a lot. You know, sometimes I haven't really had my share. I know people who've had many, many worse, you know, cards dealt to them than I have. But when we show up in Alcoholics Anonymous, we are able to help carry each other during the times when we can't do it ourselves. And then later on, we get a chance to help carry someone else who can't do it themselves, you know. And it's most often not the person that helped us that we get to help back. Which always bothered me, because I have an accounting, I'm not good at math, but if you gave me a quarter, I want to give you 30 cents. I want to be ahead, always. And it's been very frustrating to me in Alcoholics Anonymous that it never worked like that. I never get to give back the 30 cents. I got to pass it to someone else. And that's the way that it keeps on going, you know. So I can't stay even. I'm always behind. And that's a great thing. I was reading yesterday a thing in the book, which is in, I think it's in the chapter Two Wives. It's another one of those chapters that I skipped for years in AA because I wasn't a wife and my mom was never a wife. And there wasn't any reason to really read that chapter, but it says in there, you know, that a new member of Alcoholics Anonymous is kind of like a miner. A gold digger, you know, who has struck gold, and they have hit a limitless load. I mean, it's big, but they only get to keep it as long as they continue to give away the entire product. It's got to keep being passed on. You don't get to keep it unless you give it away. Let's see, what else was I... I'm going to jump again. When we talk about the psychic change or the spiritual awakening, I'm very, very grateful in Alcoholics Anonymous that this is not a program of conformity, that there are as many ways to have your own spiritual awakening as there are members. And I'm very grateful for that because I don't fall into the group that was able to come in and find something. And that doesn't mean that that group doesn't exist and that I don't, you know, not happy for that group. I'm not the person who came in and developed a relationship with a higher power that has grown and strengthened and, you know, the way that many people have. That hasn't been my experience. Mine has been one of changing this and thinking about that and not believing that and being angry at that and can't pray about that or can't pray at all or, you know, whatever it might be. And the wonderful thing is that I have still been able, through working these principles, to have the psychic change that I believe was required in order for me to stay sober. And the way that I kind of think of it is it's helped me a lot, the idea that it's a spiritual awakening. And the way that I've translated that, I'm just sharing this in case it could help anybody, you know, maybe not, but I believe that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my spirit was almost gone. There was very little left, you know, if we want to use the flame analogy or whatever, but I mean, it was just about gone. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with that tiny, tiny flame And the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, and again for me, it had a lot to do with the speakers who were sharing stories, stories of coming from a place of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization and getting to a place where they could go out in the world and enjoy life and be of service and have some fun and have a full life and long-term sobriety and a lot of laughter. And I never believed that all of that could happen for me. But I did believe that maybe it would get a little bit better. Earl and I were talking yesterday at the meeting about one of the early conventions in 1973 at the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco. And I got sober in July of 1972. And I, as I mentioned last night, I hated everything about myself. I always had, and being sober, I just was filled with shame and guilt and disgust, and I just didn't like anything. I was very uncomfortable all the time. I hated my hair. I hated being skinny. I hated the family I came from. I hated the town that I came from. I hated how stupid I thought I was. I hated my toes. I mean, I hated everything about myself. But I got very, very active in a wonderful, wonderful group in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to those 21 meetings a week, you know, every single week. And I got active in my home group. And after I was almost a year sober, they decided that they were going to go to San Francisco for this Young People's Convention. And my mom, being an alcoholic, I had grown up in my life in a lot of hotels or motels, whatever you want to call them as. You know, but they were like, you know, by the week or, you know, a couple of days. And most of the time, many times we come home and the lock is on the door and you never get in and you never get your stuff and you just move on, you know. So I knew about hotels and motels. But we all piled into a couple of cars and we drove like 9 hours to this convention. And I didn't have any money. I was not wearing shoes, you know, regularly. But, you know, they dragged me along. And we pulled up at the hotel where the convention is going to be. And it's called the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco. I don't know if any of you have ever been there. I've never been back. But I'm going to tell you the way I saw it. I saw long red velvet drapes inside. I saw chandeliers. I saw the men with like top hats and tails opening the doors of the cars. And I saw women inside wearing long dresses. And I looked in there, and I said, I am not going in there. And they go, no, this is where the convention is. It's great, you know, we're going to have this whole really fun weekend. And I sat in the car. I don't honestly remember how long. But I finally snuck into the room that we were all sharing in the hotel, terrified. I knew they were going to come over and stop me and say, hey, can't you, this is a nice, decent place. We can't have people like you coming in here. And you know, I was almost a year sober. I was there the entire weekend. It's the only convention of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever gone to, and I have been to a couple hundred at least, maybe more than that in the years. It's the only convention I've ever been to. I never went to one meeting. I was so uncomfortable. I got out of there and I walked down the stairway when I wanted to get out of the room periodically, and I walked around Skid Row where I could breathe, you know. And I guess I had a badge because I met a couple other guys, you know, out there. I met a guy from Georgia, you know, that had his badge, and we stood out there and talked about AA. But I could not, you know, be in that environment, in that hotel. And I was a year sober. You know, I just didn't feel as good as all the other people on the planet, and even the AA people, you know. And fast forward, I don't honestly remember how long it was. I'm not sure if I was 5 years or 7 years. It's longer than I thought it should take, let me promise you that. And I was sitting at a convention in Palm Springs. It was the banquet, and everybody was dressed up. I was wearing a dress someone had given me, and I was looking around the room, comparing myself to other people, something I still do on days when I want to make myself feel bad, you know. And I was looking around, and I saw like a beautiful black dress that this woman was wearing. Like, wow, does she look fantastic? It's like, yeah. I talked to myself, by the way. I said, well, don't you wish you were wearing that black dress? And I thought, no. It's like, what do you mean no? It's like, no, I'm kind of fine with this brown dress I'm wearing. It's like, what are you kidding? So I go, wait a minute. Green is your favorite color. So let's find a green dress. Okay, there's a green dress. So she looks fantastic in that dress, right? That is the most gorgeous dress in the room. Yes, it's gorgeous. So you wish you were wearing that dress, right? I thought, no. So what do you mean no? It's like, no, I'm okay with this brown dress. And you know what? I was like, okay, sitting at my table with the people at it. Not, I didn't wish I was at the fun table, you know, where they are. I didn't wish I had your mom. I didn't wish I was anything different. I didn't want to have straight hair, you know, and all of these things are like, they're pretty big. I mean, they're monumental for me, but I'm going to tell you the biggest thing that ever happened was at that moment, right then, I didn't want to feel any different than I was feeling. I never had that. I didn't have that before I started drinking. I didn't have it when I was out there drinking, unless I was so gone I couldn't feel anything. And I did not have it in those early years of sobriety. I'm sorry to say, I wish you all a faster, you know, progression than I had. But I got it that moment. And it would make a much better AA talk if I could tell you that from that moment to this, it's always been that way, but that's not true, you know. But I will tell you this, it's been many, many, many years since I've wanted to trade places with anybody. You know, I'll take all my cards. You know, in fact, a couple years ago, I was saying to my sponsor, I said, you know, if I had to go through everything again, and my sponsor's known me since I was 13 years old. He used to give me rides sometimes when I was hitchhiking. And he didn't think that was safe, and he would give me a ride. But anyway, I was saying to him, I said, you know, Bob, if I had to do it all over again, just to be where I am right now, to have the people in my life that I have, to have the life that I have, I said, you know, I would do it all again. And he said, please don't. I don't want to go through it with you. Okay, so when I started to tell you about Sybil, I wanted to also tell you that this other final story that I'll kind of leave you with. When I was 35 years sober, I went to Hawaii to a town named Kona, and it's a place that I had gone to a number of times with my kids, and a place where I went to a lot of meetings, and a place that I really, really loved. And so when I was 35 years sober, I had come out of that divorce. I was still, you know, feeling very shattered or, you know, whatever, sad, you know, a lot of different emotions. But that's where I decided I wanted to celebrate my 35-year birthday, as well as at my home group, certainly, when I came back. And so I took my three daughters, and I went to Kona, and they do a cake once a month there. And I took a cake, and when I took that cake, I told a story about Sybil, which I'm going to try and, maybe I'll just tell you what it was now, and then I'll finish with this part. So the story that I said very quickly when I took my cake was, I said, you know, as I stand up here tonight, I'm 35 years sober. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was less than 30 days sober. I went to one of my regular meetings, and a woman named Sybil spoke at the meeting, and she had 32 years. And when Sybil spoke that night, she was just amazing. She had great enthusiasm. She really was a wonderful, wonderful woman. And she said at one point, I think when she was closing her talk, she said, and newcomers, which I was one of them, newcomers, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, you are going to have an amazing journey ahead of you. And she said, I have an amazing life. And she said, and do you know, if I could wave a magic wand and just give you this amazing life, she said, I wouldn't do it. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, well, that's mean. I mean, first of all, you know, I'm from Venice. I know there are no magic wands. But she should say, I wish I could wave my magic wand. She didn't even want to, you know. And she said, I wouldn't do it. She said, because I wouldn't want to rob you of the journey. Now I'm sitting there, I'm 30 days sober. I have no place to live. I have no family. I'm facing court cases and being deported. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, I don't want the journey. Do you know what I mean? It's like, just wave the wand. I mean, I want, you know, let's have something change here now. But what I said when I took my cake in Kona was I said, today, I understand and I'm so grateful, you know, that no one, but of course no one is able to for anybody, but that no one was able to rob me of my journey, you know. And I wouldn't want anyone here today to try and rob you of your journey, whatever it may be. I have no idea. I certainly have no idea what mine's going to be or what it's been. It's been, you know, it's like a book with pages that just sort of show up in it, you know. So back to Sybil for a minute. So when I finished talking, you know, a guy came up to me who I actually knew because I'd gone to those meetings for a number of years, and he said, I heard that Sybil once when I was on the mainland. And I said, oh yeah, yeah. And he said, you know, she gave me a letter that Bill Wilson wrote to her. I said, really? I mean, I knew Sybil. I mean, I'm not like saying she was my very best friend, but I mean, I went to dinner with Sybil. I was at her house. I visited Bob and Sybil. I went to all kinds of meetings with Sybil. He said, yeah. He said, one time I heard her speak and she mentioned a letter that she read that Bill Wilson had written her. And I said, wow. And he said, I have the letter. I said, really? He said, yeah, if you want a copy, if you come to the morning meeting at the beach tomorrow, I'll bring it to you. And he did. And I brought the letter here and I'm gonna read it to you and then I'm gonna leave it with whoever wants it, and maybe you guys can make copies if you want to, you know. It was interesting because I already had planned to do this. I had this in my suitcase, and when Mark and I were at the airport, I just checked my email, and I have a friend in New York who sends me historical facts of about AA, you know, periodically. And one of the historical facts I did not know was that Sybil got sober in March. And so I thought it was particularly, you know, cool that I was planning on talking about her and bringing you guys this letter, and it's March. So, okay. I want to tell you, I guess, one other part. I mentioned Tex, who had gone to that meeting. Tex got sober also. And Tex was to start the oldest Alano club that we have in Los Angeles. It's called A Hole in the Ground. You had to climb down a bunch of stairs, a couple levers of stairs to go, and it still exists. And he worked with lots and lots of guys and sponsored lots and lots of guys. And the reason for this letter was that Sybil had written to Bill Wilson. She was 11 years sober, and she was having a really hard time. Her and Tex were very close friends and business partners. And the business that they had been in had failed and had gone bankrupt and they'd lost all their money. And then Tex got really sick and Tex died. And then Sybil came home one night and her husband was there. And when she walked in, he said, Sybil, I know what we need to do to make our marriage better. I've finally figured it out. And he said, I like you better when you drink. And he poured her a glass of wine. And she went upstairs and she got her suitcase and she left and she never went back. And I guess at this point, she wrote a letter to Bill Wilson. I don't have that letter, although I think it's somewhere, so maybe someday I'll see a copy, but I have the letter that Bill Wilson wrote back to her. So it's dated November 6th, 1952. My dear Sybil, thanks for your letter of October 21st. It was just about the most stirring thing I've read in many a day. The real test of our way of life is how it works when the chips are down. Though I've sometimes seen AAs make rather a mess of living, I've never seen a sober one make a bad job of dying. But the account you give me of Texas last days is something I shall treasure always. I hope I can do half as well when my own time comes. I am one who believes that in my father's house there are many mansions. If that were not so, there couldn't be any justice. I can almost see Tex sitting on the front porch of one right now, talking in the sunlight with others of God's ladies and gentlemen who have gone on before. I certainly agree with you that little was left in Tex's grave. All he had was left behind in the hearts of the rest of us, and he carried just that same amount forward to where he is now. If you like what I've said, please read it to the Huntington Park group. In any case, congratulate them for me that they had the privilege of knowing a guy like Tex. As for you, my dear, there's no need to give you advice. How well you understand that the demonstration is the thing after all. It isn't so much a question of whether we have a good time or a bad time. The only thing that will be asked
is what we do with the experience we have. That you are doing well with your tough lot is something for which I and many others are bound to be grateful. This is but a long day in school. Some of the lessons are hard, and others are easy. I know you will keep on learning and passing what you learned. What more does one person need to know about another? Affectionately yours, Bill. So I'll leave this up here for a member of the committee if they would like. And thank you.